Good morning. Earlier this month, a federal judge said a Hawaii County policy violates constitutional rights of a prospective employee. We'll talk with the attorney who argued the case. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. In recent years, we've had several demonstrations of what can happen when a natural disaster hits, but what about other risks? A national preparedness expert has some advice for Hawaii later this hour. It's Monday, March 23rd. This is The Conversation.
And twice a year, the members of the Garden Isle Orchid Society put their best efforts on display. Today, Society member Ada Quinne gives us a preview of the Spring Fantasy Orchid Show. I'm Chris Vandercook. Kauai is also home to one of Hawaii's spectacular attractions, the Makawahi Cave, is an entryway into Hawaii's past. We'll take a virtual tour. But first, this news.
Welcome to a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Taking a look at drug testing this morning, huh?
Well, taking a look at what is appropriate when you're applying for a job.
Yeah.
And what should not be asked of you. That's a part of our first conversation this morning. Now, not long ago, a Kailua Kona woman was set to begin a new job with Hawaii County. But after giving her a conditional job offer, the county said she, like all prospective employees, would need to submit to a urinalysis. That didn't go over very well, especially as she'd been hired for a typical desk job. Earlier this month, a federal judge agreed. Adam Wolf's firm and the ACLU had sued on behalf of Rebecca Taylor Failer, and Adam Wolf joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for talking about this, because most people, when they're going after a job, expect that, you know, there are going to be a couple of interviews, maybe going to be sitting down with other people who maybe they might be working with. But how common is the idea that if you're going after a job, someone may ask you to have to submit other things like a urinalysis?
Well, it's not particularly common, and thankfully so. There are rules that the Constitution applies, particularly when you have the government as your employer, and it's the government, therefore, that's asking you to submit to something like a urinalysis. And it's because that it's unconstitutional, as it applies to our client, Rebecca, we filed a lawsuit, and fortunately, the court entered relief that allows her to start her job without submitting to that urinalysis.
So if this is not a common practice, how is it that it became so with the County of Hawaii? Although, yes, it's governmental, but we're talking about a desk job.
We are talking about a desk job. And really, at the heart of our case are two aspects of the County of Hawaii's pre-employment testing regime. The first is that the county requires all of its employees to submit to a very invasive medical questionnaire. Things like whether you've ever had a sexually transmitted disease, whether you've ever had hemorrhoids, whether you've suffered from other rectal conditions, whether you've ever gone to the emergency room, things that you don't want to talk about with anybody but your doctor. These are very sensitive issues, and the last people you want to talk about this with are your employer and the government, and here the County of Hawaii requires both.
Go ahead.
The second aspect of our challenge is that the County of Hawaii, in addition to the medical questionnaire, requires its employees to submit to a urinalysis. That is something that happens more often in the private sector, but very rarely in the public sector, and that's because the Supreme Court has been quite clear that for almost all jobs, requiring a urinalysis is unconstitutional.
Because they've said that it's unconstitutional, and because you've mentioned that this is such an invasive questionnaire, how is it that the County of Hawaii has been able to go this long without having a challenge?
Well, our client, Rebecca, has what very few people have had, which is the courage of her convictions to stand up. so many of us can look at that and say, that's really inappropriate. It's really unreasonable. I don't want to submit to it. And yet, this is my employer. I don't want to lose my job, so I'll just do it. And so for years and years and years, people have applied to the county of Hawaii for their jobs and have undergone this unconstitutional, embarrassing, and terribly invasive medical examination. We got a call from Rebecca and said, you know, she said, I really don't want to do this. I'm so uncomfortable about it. And so we filed this lawsuit on her behalf and also on behalf of all of the other people in the county who have been subjected to and will be subjected to these unconstitutional tests.
With everything that's happened beforehand, and as you mentioned, because not everyone had the backbone of your client, it still means that the county has a lot of information about a lot of people. How is that information being protected, or is it not?
One of the things that we'll determine in this case is what the county is doing with that information. And that really has two dimensions. The first is, once they have it, you know, how do they store it? Is it confidential? Who gets to see it? Why do they retain it? And the second aspect of it is, once somebody gives them this information, what does the county do in terms of rescinding job offers, if ever? So to give you an example, they wanted to test Rebecca's urine to find its protein levels, its sugar levels, its ketones. And those are the types of things that may sound scientific, but really skewed results there could show whether you have cancer or vaginal secretions or urinary tract infections. And so the question is the county really rescinding anybody's job offer because their ketone levels are skewed? The answer must be no. And if it's no, the question is, why are they doing it?
Well, there are other implications here, too. If they find out all of that information about you, might that also have some implications with insurance?
You know, it could have implications in a whole host of dimensions, but the primary one here is just the handing over of this very sensitive medical information is a serious infringement on our privacy and a violation of the Constitution, and it really needs to stop.
So what happens now, Adam, with this one? What does this mean going forward for other, perhaps, jobs where people have been treated similarly?
Sure. So in our case, we got a very good ruling from the federal court saying that Rebecca can start work without submitting to this urinalysis. And what we're going to do is to try to get that relief extended to other people in Rebecca's situation with the county. There are scores of people applying for jobs with the county who are being subjected to these unconstitutional tests. And part of what our case is going to try to do is to extend the relief that we've gotten for Rebecca to other people in her situation. And to the extent that this exists, that this practice exists on the other islands, I think it's worth a conversation about why the counties are doing this and trying to get it to stop.
So how are we having that conversation, or is that conversation just being started now?
To the best of my understanding, that conversation is starting now, that this conversation that we're having, that the conversation people have at their kitchen tables, that people should be talking about this, people should be talking with their employer, and their government employers should be doing everything they can to comply, have their pre-employment examinations comply with the Constitution and respect their employees' privacy.
So what would you advise someone who is out on the job hunt now and maybe applying for a job similar to Rebecca's?
Sure. I mean, this is happening all the time, and I field calls from people who are going through this and have questions and concerns about it. And if they have those questions, they should call me. They should call the ACLU. They should talk with their peers about it. We should be moving toward a place where the government employer is asking only those things that it's allowed to ask under the Constitution, and that really it has a need to ask as an employer.
Things that are germane to the job.
Exactly. You can ask what somebody's prior experience was. You can ask why they would be good at a job. All the types of questions you get in an interview. What do you not do as well? What would your peers say about you? But there is no way that the government should be able to ask, you know, what your sugar levels are, whether you have a sexually transmitted infection, what your ketone levels are, do you have diabetes, have you ever been to the hospital? Those sorts of things should be, must be, off limits.
So, Adam Wolf, what's the next step for this?
Sure. The court granted what's called a temporary restraining order against the County of Hawaii. It's basically short-term relief that allowed our client, Rebecca, to start her job. We are going to move on Friday, the court, to extend that into an order of longer duration. And we're also going to ask the court to what's called certify a class, which is to make sure that the protections that Rebecca has now received and hopefully will receive going forward extend to all of Rebecca's peers, to her similarly situated fellow employees, so that they don't need to suffer under these constitutional violations, too.
All right, Adam, we will be watching. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for your time.
Adam Wolf is a nationally recognized constitutional lawyer, a partner at Pfeiffer, Roscoe & Wolf. He's argued before the U.S. Supreme Court and courts of appeals throughout the country. His firm and the ACLU sued Hawaii County on behalf of a woman who did not want to submit to urinalysis as a condition of her new desk job.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15, and coming up, Kauai orchid-growing community gears up for its spring show. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, o mau, o kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's backyard quiz, well, for you English majors, you might think this is an easy one. Today we're thinking about one of America's greatest authors who passed through Hawaii in the early 1800s as part of a life of seagoing adventure. He came to the Pacific on the crew of a whaling ship and spent time in Lahaina and Honolulu before returning to the East Coast, where he lived out his days. One of his fictional characters described his situation as a young man this way, quote, "Having little or no money in my purse and nothing in particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world." That he did, signing on as an ordinary seaman on a new whaling ship, sailing from New Bedford, Massachusetts in January 1841. It was during his time as a whaler that he likely learned of the tragedy of the Essex, a ship that was rammed and sunk by a huge sperm whale. That maritime disaster became the basis of his most famous novel, and today we're looking for the name of this 19th century whaler turned author. You can call us with the answer at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to give it to us, I will walk away with an HPRT.
Good morning. I'm Liam Skilling from the William S. Richardson School of Law. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Orchid growers are a world unto themselves, a worldwide community of growers and hobbyists caught up by the flower's endless variety and their particular beauty. There's some 25,000 species of orchids around the world, some of which may have been around for 80 million years, coexisting with dinosaurs. That gives orchid fanciers plenty to talk about at gatherings like this weekend's annual Spring Fantasy Orchid Show, sponsored by the Garden Island Orchid Society. Ada Koine is one of the show's coordinators. She's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Ada.
Good morning.
You've got quite an enthusiastic community there, don't you?
Yes, we do.
How large a group is it?
Well, the Orchid Society, the Garden Isle Orchid Society, has about 100 members. Uh-huh. And then there's a second society over on the other side of the island. And I think they have about 50 members.
These can't all be professional growers, right?
No, a lot of hobbyists. We have about 7 professional growers.
How much do you have to know to become an orchid grower at your home?
Well, you know, you can kind of muddle through, but there's no sense in doing that because it's so easy to go to the society and they have someone there at the beginning of each meeting, which is every other month, and you can ask all the questions you want.
There's a lot you can do with orchids in terms of kind of exploring different ways to cross-pollinate, right?
Yes. I've watched one of our growers. She was cross-pollinating some dendrobiums, and she had all of her dendrobiums out on a table, and then she picked 3 that she wanted to cross-pollinate. But the thing is, you have to wait for several years before you see what you may have created a nightmare, you know, the wrong colors or colors don't match, but it's a challenge.
But there is you can really get involved in the life of the plant itself, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As you said, there are 30 you said 25, but I've read 30,000 species and uh-huh. 800 genera. Well, you can just go forever and not see all of them. So I think that's part of the challenge of people collecting one more orchid, you know, but you can never have them all.
Well, it's one of the most,
it's the largest plant family in the world.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems to have, you know, the orchid growers don't seem to treat it as one of a number of flowers. It seems to be it's all about orchids for you folks.
Yes, yes. It's quite a challenge. You know, when orchids first were discovered around 1800s, people went wild, just like in Holland when they started developing the tulips. And
yeah.
Some people went bankrupt buying and selling tulips. Well, that's what happened with the orchids.
Really?
And like in South America, if somebody discovered a new orchid and he didn't want to share it, he would take a collection for himself and then destroy all of those orchids in that forest.
Wow. And they sort of be proprietary about a particular...
Yeah, because then they became worth a lot of money.
Well, because I know that the whole tulip bulb thing in Holland almost bankrupted the whole country.
Well, it bankrupted some people. And but anyway, now, of course, they're very cheap. But this was at a time when people had a lot of money to spend, I lived in Holland for some time, and I see that the people actually went bonkers over some of these tulips, and they brought them up from Turkey.
Is Kauai a particularly good place to grow orchids?
Well, all of the islands are good, but most of the big growers are on the big island.
Uh-huh.
First of all, they have more space, and then orchids need a different environments. I mean, some grow close, I live in Poipu, and some of the orchids will grow well down here in a drier climate.
Uh-huh.
Others like it cooler. And one of the growers, Hanalei Orchids, he's a little further up in the mountains and more moist.
And so that would be an entirely different group of orchids than what you have down where you are. Because you're down near sea level, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, that would make big difference.
Yeah. But we have a grower here that raises beautiful orchids, and so he just, you know, he's very talented at it and knows them very well.
What kind of information do you exchange at events like this one coming up?
Well, we have someone at the door that will show you how to pot or repot the orchids and talk to you about the type of medium and the type of fertilizer to use. And then at the orchid show, usually we'll have about 30 genera at the show, but there'll be, a lot more orchids. But you can talk to the growers and tell them. Several of the growers will be there, and they're selling their orchids. And you can talk to them then when you have a problem. But I think the best thing to do is to join one of the societies, because they always have very interesting speakers, not only from here, but also from the other islands. And so I would encourage them to join the Garden Isle Orchid Society.
I think it sounds like a pretty good idea.
www.thegardenislandorchidsociety.org.
Great, Ada. Thanks very much. Yeah. We'll send people your way. Ada Coene is a member of the Garden Island Orchid Society, which will be having its annual Spring Fantasy Orchid Show this Friday and Saturday at the United Church of Christ in Hanapepe. At the same time, the Kauai Art and Orchids Festival will be held in Hanapepe Town. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Will Assad survive the civil war that has produced 200,000 dead and millions displaced? Can the defeat of ISIS and regime change in Syria be the policy of the United States? Or is it one or the other? UN Ambassador Samantha Power next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, following the conversation.
Contributions for Challenge 2015 support the purchase, creation, and delivery of HPR services to the station's 175,000 weekly statewide listeners. We gratefully acknowledge Wendella Van Heek of Kaunakakai, Francis Merriman of Honolulu, and Drinda Maxwell of Honolulu. Thank you all for your early gifts. When it comes to pledge drives, it's not a matter of if we'll reach the designated goal, it's when. And you know that early giving can mean fewer on-air pledge days. It's your call. Many first-time givers are choosing the convenience of HPR's $10 a month sustaining member program. You can find out about it and get a secure donation form at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providers of auto, home, commercial, and specialty lines of insurance since 1911. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
After Hawaii passed a pesticide disclosure law, the state says it can't enforce it. The reason? Concerns over the release of proprietary business information. Civil Beat took a look at why the Department of Agriculture hasn't posted the pesticide sales records online. Reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we're talking about what was mandated under Act 105 from 2 years ago.
Right, and let me just give you some background. So Representative Dee Morikawa, she's from Kauai, and she was responding to concerns in her district about pesticide spraying by large agricultural companies like Syngenta. So the law that actually got passed is considerably watered down, but yes, it has not been implemented by the Department of Agriculture. That organization is concerned about being sued, actually, for posting this information, and the Attorney General's office is also working with the DOE to see if they can get the information online 2 years after the bill's passage. But as the AG's office told Anita Hofschneider, a reporter, it's been very time-consuming and complex to get that information online, and there are legal concerns.
Those legal concerns weren't part of the discussion 2 years ago?
You know, I wasn't there for the hearings, and that's a very good question. I can tell you that ag companies were concerned about that bill, were not in support of it. And as you know, pesticide use has been a big discussion point, particularly on the county, the neighbor islands and so forth. But the concern here is that here's what the information actually would be. It would actually include the pesticide dealers' customers and what they're buying, the mix of those pesticides being used, and how much of it is being used. So this is this proprietary information right. that the DOA and the state are worried about releasing.
But that all that said, how do we cope with the fact that we've got the mandate for what this law says should be available to the public online and the lack of ability to do it? What's going to be the bridge, if there is one, and how soon is any of that possibly going to be online?
This would not be the first time that the legislature has passed something and that it hasn't been implemented right away, but we can tell you that the AG and the DOA are working on this. A spokesperson for the Department of Ag says they hope to get that information up maybe in the next couple of months. In the meantime, there's another bill moving through. Josh Green from the Big Island, the senator, he's got his own legislation that would require farms, which of course use pesticide, to have monthly disclosure reports. And he's upset that the bill in 2013 has not been implemented. He told Anita, he said, who's in charge, the chemical companies or the Department of Agriculture? You know, he says we need to man up, or rather they need to man up and take control of the situation.
Well, we're going to wait and see if the DOA is able to put those things online, because that still doesn't necessarily address the concern about the legality issues and whether or not the state will be sued, or whether that should even be a concern in putting up information that people are looking for.
Right. And an attorney for Earth Justice said, look, it's just nonsense. The state is reluctant to make the changes that the law clearly requires.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see what happens and talk to you tomorrow. Have a good Monday.
Of course. Thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, it's the one thing we really dread about aging, isn't it?
The fact that we are, absolutely.
Loss of memory in particular, yeah?
Well, it's memory loss, it's changes in your body, it's changes in a variety of different things. It seems so cruel that as people get older and need more complicated medications and different schedules, that's exactly when the memory goes, and it makes it harder than ever to try and figure all of this out. So we're going to talk with a holistic geriatrician today and find out what she means by holistic and sort of see what her approach is to taking care of complicated health problems as people get older.
Holistic implies that it's kind of a full body and mind integrated approach, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. And in this case, it also involves family, mm-hmm. because we do know that there are a lot of people here who are taking care of their elderly loved ones. And so we can't just take care of the older patient or person. We have to look at how this dynamic affects the whole family, because they really become important pieces of the puzzle.
Sure. How to take care of people effectively, huh?
Absolutely, as a team approach. You know, we can't expect that everyone else is going to do it for an individual. We kind of have to all get together, the doctors and the families and social workers and loved ones, and really all try and find a way to keep this person healthy and safe. And that's really the key. And we're all going to get there. We're all getting older, Chris. It's time is going by.
That's what I've heard, Kathy. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
Valuable information on The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Here's a question for you. Who knows your neighborhood best? Well, probably you and the other people in it. That idea is behind a conference happening this week to plan how to reduce risk in times of disaster. In Hawaii, we don't have to look far back into our collective memory to recall what can happen when we have or haven't prepared for a natural disaster. But those aren't the only threats. Dr. Mark Keim made a career at the Centers for Disease Control and now heads the firm he founded. It's called Disaster Doc. He's speaking this week at the Pacific Risk Management Ohana Conference, and he joins us in our studio this morning. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
The idea of assessing risk when there isn't one and trying to make a plan before you need it sounds very much like the macro version of that old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. But in this case, it has a lot of dollar signs attached to it. What's the comparative value from what you've seen in the work that you've done around the world and around the nation where we actually have a plan in place well before we need it?
Well, if we can reduce the risk or prevent people from becoming injured or ill in a disaster, studies have shown that we can save actually quite a bit of money. In the United States, that number is for every $1 spent reducing risk, we save around $4 to $7 in response and recovery. Worldwide, the World Bank has found that that number goes up to $20 saved. But more importantly, it's actually a more humane approach rather than allowing people to become injured and then trying to respond and put back the pieces in their lives. We prevent them from becoming injured and from going through these kinds of crises themselves.
It's not all about the money, but that certainly is a way of leveraging a conversation sometimes with people who may know this intuitively. It sounds good. It's like if someone tells you that you should lose weight or eat well or do all those other things, but until you're really threatened with something, you may not take action. Your point is that we have to get over that and be able to understand that communities are different. They know their people best and should be having an integrated plan with, you know, all of the region to be able to fit into what might happen if there's a disaster of whatever type, natural or man-made.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, the rest of the world, and much of the world actually, has already started down that path because they simply could never afford to do the kinds of responses that we have been at least fortunate enough to mount. So it's unfortunate that we've had the disasters, but fortunate that we've had a lot of resources that we can pour into the response phase. But in other countries, they don't have that kind of a mechanism, and so they've been working on reducing their risk for quite a few years, and that's been a very popular mode now for the past 10 to 15 years. And so we in the United States now can learn from those and apply those in ways that are unique to our own communities and our own regions.
As you look at Hawaii and you've had a lot of experience here, we know that one island certainly isn't like another. There are some commonalities, but there are differences in neighborhoods. Hilo is not Kailua. How do you start to create and engage a community to look at the people in it, including people who may be marginalized?
Well, actually, that's a very important principle of disaster risk reduction. It must be done at the community level. You can't have people coming from the outside or from the upside and walking in and trying to decide things. And so, the principles of community-based action are actually been very well developed over the past several decades, where we come in and work with communities on a wide variety of issues, whether it be economic or health or development or health equities or equality and so on. So the idea is to have the intent to do so, that you must want to be able to share, you want to be inclusive. It's really more of an ohana approach. And after that, then it's being inclusive and allowing that community to be able to have an input into the process and sharing with them what are their risks and giving them an informed consent to participate, and then empowering that group to be able to make those kinds of changes. And sometimes, and actually not just sometimes, many times, it's something relatively simple that's not very expensive. This doesn't have to be a high-tech kind of process. And I can give you one example. In Micronesia, there are areas where they have hillsides that are prone to landslides. And whenever there's a hurricane, and there are quite a few every year, heavy rains cause landslides. So you can go through those hillsides, identify exactly which ones are going to have landslides. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Geological Survey has already done that. There are maps that have that. And so one of the ideas was, when it's raining, why can't we just go live with our auntie? You may not be able to save your home, but you can go to where your auntie lives, which is outside of the landslide area itself, spend the night or during that storm with them. And then if the landslide occurs, of course, you lose your property, but you don't lose your life. You don't lose your family. And in that sense, it's a very low-tech way to be able to adjust and adapt to these kinds of storms that we know are going to be increasing over time.
Low tech, excuse me, but high touch. And yeah. As you apply that to other situations here, like, for example, with homeless populations that may migrate around town or may spring up, of, you know, I'm thinking about out in Kaka'ako, where you can walk for all through the little finger streets back there and see them tent lined, and other places like that too. But that population may or may not be engaged unless somebody makes the effort to engage them.
Well, we know that actually populations that are not engaged, that are either politically disenfranchised or ethnically or minority or racially and so on, we know that those populations are at higher risk. And in prior history of disasters, there have been higher numbers of deaths among those types of populations. So we have to recognize that and to work proactively. Coming in afterwards, after the disaster, is often just too little and too late. So once again, reaching out to those populations, identifying what their needs are. And it's really a no-regret option, isn't it? You don't have to wait for the disaster to want good housing and want safe food and safe water and health care for people, because it's sort of as the tide rises, all boats rise along with it. And so if none of us have, if some of us don't have health care, some of us don't have health equity, perhaps then all of us don't have that. And so by helping to bring that together with the communities and link them together, I think we make a better social network. We also increase our livelihoods. People who previously may have been dependent become customers. They become consumers. They become business owners. And so all people tend to benefit from this idea of a no-regret option.
Markheim, it sounds like that you're making an argument for sort of a backdoor weaving of a social network, but using the issue of risk to be able to do it.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we really have to recognize with climate change in particular, is that if the premise of climate change is that we're going to see disasters increase over the next 100 years, they're going to be more severe, flooding here in the Pacific, hurricanes, as well as landslides. We can either pay the price in a way that is a no-regret option, where we build our resilience, we build protection of these populations, or we can pay it all at once in huge lump sums that will get more and more expensive as time goes by. Typhoon Haiyan, the recent typhoon in Vanuatu, are examples of some of the most severe storms in history. We also have other examples where very, very expensive, Superstorm Sandy, one of the most expensive storms in history as well. So the idea is certainly not that we wouldn't necessarily pay for it. We will pay for it. It's just cheaper and more humane to do so in advance. Back to the same adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
All right. Sounds like that's a good place for us to stop for the moment. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Markheim is retired from a career at the Centers for Disease Control and is the founder and CEO of Disaster Doc. It's an international consultant firm located in Atlanta, Georgia. He twice received the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary's Award for Distinguished Service for his work as co-lead for the CDC emergency operations during the World Trade Center and anthrax letter emergencies in 2001, and again for Hurricane Katrina in 2006. He will be the keynote speaker at this week's 2015 Pacific Risk Management Ohana Conference, focused on disaster management and resiliency for island and coastal communities.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a 19th century author whose adventures in the South Seas as a crew member on whaling ships brought him to the Hawaiian Islands. He sailed out of New Bedford, Massachusetts in 1841 aboard the whaler Acushnet, jumped ship a year and a half later at Nukuhiva in the Marquesas Islands. He left those islands aboard an Australian whaler, deserting that ship when he got to Tahiti, where he lived a beachcomber's life for a few months. He then found his way to Lahaina and Honolulu, working as a pin setter in a bowling alley and a bookkeeper before finding his way back to the East Coast. His early Pacific adventures became the basis of his early works Taipei, Omo'o, and White Jacket. His masterpiece, though, was based on the story of the whaler Essex, attacked and sunk by a sperm whale in the southern Pacific Ocean in 1820. That episode became the 1851 novel Moby Dick, about the last survivor of a doomed whaling ship. This morning we asked you for the author's name, and by now you probably knew we were after Herman Melville.
And there were several people who knew that. In fact, two Pauls and two Davids, although it was Paul Morgan from Kailua who called us first. Thanks very much for knowing that. We also heard from David Goldberg from Ina Haina, Paul Spence in Kailua, and David Kangas from Molokai in Konakakai. Thanks very much for your calls. And if you've got a quiz for us, well, you can send that in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Ciao, I'm Ben Soda from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue this conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in our island skies, plus what's happening in the world of astronomy. We're joined, as usual, by Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, and this week's report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week's Stargazers, Venus and Mars continue to be seen in the western horizon. Both of these planets can be seen just after sunset. Mars will set at around 8 p.m., followed by Venus at around about 9. Jupiter will be visible in the eastern sky from sunset onwards, while Saturn will rise around about 10:50 p.m. Now, our moon is beginning to wax and will be approaching its first quarter phase towards the end of the week. This, of course, means our skies should still be great for stargazing.
Now, this week we are getting an advance holiday-themed sort of story, because Christopher has told me it has to do with Christmas lights on Mars.
Yeah, that's right. NASA's MAVEN spacecraft has been monitoring the red planet since it entered orbit in September 2014. During the 2014 Christmas period, MAVEN noticed some extraordinary activity on the Martian atmosphere. It saw Martian aurora.
This would look similar to northern lights here on Earth?
It's very similar, but the particulars are a little different. Some stargazers who were lucky enough to see the northern lights on St. Patrick's Day last week would have been treated to an amazing display of green dancing lights. Amazingly, this was visible as far south as Virginia and even Hampshire in the UK. The aurora on Mars were not as colorful or as visible as ours, but they produced quite a show for MAVEN.
And what would make the Martian aurora not as powerful?
Well, the answer to that is magnetism. The core of the Earth generates an enormous magnetic field that fills the space around our planet. It's the reason we can use magnetic compass for navigation. This magnetic field protects us from charged particles from the sun. Mars, on the other hand, doesn't have an active core, and so its magnetic field is very, very weak.
Now, what does the magnetic thing have to do with the lights?
Well, that's all down to the sun. The sun is constantly throwing stuff out into space. We have solar flares, radiation, all sorts of particles. When this stuff impacts the magnetic field around the Earth, the particles give off light. We see this light as the aurora borealis or the aurora australis, the northern and southern lights.
So the northern lights on St. Patrick's Day, that was a big solar storm.
Exactly. It was caused by the sun throwing a tantrum, not by an excess of Guinness amongst stargazers.
Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, thank you so much for this week's report.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You are welcome. And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Opportunities to see Hawaii as it once was are all too rare, especially if you wonder what these islands were like before people came here. You can get a hint, at least, from Hawaii's largest limestone cave, Makauhi Cave on Kauai. It's a place of living history, the largest fossil site in the islands, whose caretakers are not only gathering together fossil relics, they're restoring native habitat in the surrounding area. They're offering tours this Thursday, Kuhio Day, and Dr. David Burney of the Makauhi Cave Reserve is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, David.
Aloha, Chris.
I like the emphasis that you're putting on the future as well as the past there. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, that's sort of our motto. You know, we say Makauhi Cave, where past and future meet.
because we use the evidence from the past to help guide our decisions about how to restore the place.
What kind of evidence?
Well, this is the richest fossil site in the entire Hawaiian Islands. In fact, many scientists say it's the richest in the whole Pacific region. And so there are thousands of years of accumulation of plant and animal fossils, beautifully preserved. The preservation is so good that there's still fragmentary DNA. Many kinds of things that normally would decay away in a site are preserved in this kind of giant pickling jar that sinkhole represents.
What accounts for the pickling?
Well, this place has an unusual chemistry where the fossils are accumulated below the water table for the most part, mm-hmm. and the oxygen is cut off, and the pH, that is the acidity or alkalinity, is almost exactly neutral, which is the sort of the Goldilocks zone for fossils. It means that nearly all kinds of plant and animal fossils are preserved together in the same place. So we get a very complete picture of the entire landscape over the last 10,000 years, time before humans, time when humans arrived, and then everything that happened in the Polynesian period, right up till the present, is recorded in there.
If it were either too acidic or too alkaline, these things would have decayed, right?
Well, that's right. If it's very acidic, plant fossils will still be preserved, pollen and spores mm-hmm. and seeds, leaves, wood. But the animal fossils, the bones of the extinct birds and the shells of the rare and extinct land snails, they wouldn't be preserved. On the other hand, if it's very alkaline, you get the animal fossils, but the plant fossils decay away. There's just a narrow zone in the middle. And I've worked on a number of sites around the world that have these characteristics, but they're fairly rare. It's really the one in a thousand kind of fossil site.
And so the benefits are, obviously, you get to study a period in the past that you really couldn't study any other way, could you?
Well, that's right. All our evidence about the past is indirect. In Hawaii, we have, of course, the great benefit of a long and very rich and detailed oral tradition. The Hawaiians recorded their history by passing it down verbally, and so we have that back to that point.
Yeah.
But to know what it was like before humans arrived requires fossils. There really is no other way to know much about it.
What are some of the, in the animal realm, what are some of the species that have gone extinct?
Well, we found about 45 different kinds of bird fossils in there, and about half of those are extinct species. Our favorites are what we call the moanalo, the lost fowl. And these are giant extinct ducks and geese that mm-hmm. were flightless. They didn't need to fly. They were the biggest guys around. They were our grazers and browsers on the Hawaiian landscape before the advent of mammals introduced by people. So those big birds were really special. Unique to Hawaii, all went extinct after the arrival of humans fairly quickly. And if you want to imagine what they were like, you can sort of think of something like the dodo of Mauritius, that famous giant pigeon from the Indian Ocean island. Only our dodo-like birds were actually descended from ducks and geese.
And were great big, edible, easily catchable victims when humans showed up.
Well,
right?
Of course, and presumably it would be like it is everywhere else that we know about. When humans first arrive, the animals have no fear of humans. They have no sense that this strange new two-legged creature is somehow a threat. And, you know, the Hawaiians really can't be blamed for making a meal of them. They had no idea, of course, how many there were, and they had to feed their families. And traditionally Hawaiians are strong conservationists, but you got to remember that in many indigenous cultures you have this conservation ethic, but it's a learned skill. People have to adapt to the environment in a local place, and they have to survive, but then they have to eventually figure out how to sustain that survival. And there's so much we can learn from ancient Hawaiians about how to manage the landscape here sustainably today.
Well, sustainability is sort of inevitably a product of generations passing, right? The first generation to arrive is going to eat what it can to survive.
Of course, it's a trial and error thing. And the same thing has happened worldwide. I study this phenomenon around the world of what a place is like before humans and how it changes when humans arrive. So for me, the most important moment in time is that initial contact between people and this naive fauna.
this is really that's what's unique about the cave, is that it really can take you to that exact place in history, can't it?
Well, that's right, and people can see an actual dig in progress, and so it's an opportunity to see real science at work. But it also is an opportunity to see our, this is the future part now, to see our visualizations of what that landscape might have looked like, because on the 17 acres surrounding the site, which we lease, my wife Lida Pigott Burney and I lease this from Grove Farm Company, we've been there for almost 25 years now, we have planted thousands of native plants with the help of volunteers and school kids.
And that's
and
where the
ones
future
we choose are the ones that are common as fossils in the site. So it's an opportunity. It's a little bit like a poor man's Jurassic Park. You know, you can see what we imagine the landscape looked like when the first Hawaiians arrived.
Well, David, we're going to send some people your way. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, it'd be good to see you over here again, Chris.
It sure would. Dr. David Burney of the Makawahi Cave Reserve is offering tours of the site this Thursday, Kuhio Day, on Kauai. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
On the next Humankind, following the atrocity of the Boston Marathon bombing, which left hundreds killed or maimed, what would justice mean for the bomber who committed the crime at age 19? Also, how educators address the widespread problem of bullying in schools. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Bethann, when you just get a new job, the last thing you want to do is rock the boat. But I was really surprised at the level of detail that they wanted from this one woman in terms of urinalysis and medical information just to get a fairly ordinary job.
With Hawaii County.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the point, that they would be getting far more information than they would need to have to judge whether or not she would be suitable for their team and whether they're looking for drug abuse or not. There's so many other things that come with that medical information done by those tests.
Yeah, it sounded really problematic. It'll be interesting to follow that story.
And we will. And tomorrow you're going to be talking about how Hawaiians played a role in the American Civil War.
Yeah, a Maui novelist has looked at the history and created a fictional story around that. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning.
Oh, good. We've talked about it in real life. It'll be interesting to see what happens in this novel. That's going to do it for us for today. But you know we like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line anytime you like. That number is 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org if you like that better, or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. You can tweet us at HI Conversation or get to me at BKOZHPR.
And you can find past shows at HPR2.org under The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation right here. Have a good Monday.